You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, Candy won, Candy won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved.
Many stones can form an arch.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. This is Judy Ansel. Tonight's show is being underwritten by United Auto Workers Local 249 and Missouri AFL-CIO. United Auto Workers Local 249 members build the best Ford trucks and vans in the world, and the Missouri AFL-CIO representing 250,000 working families in Missouri. We thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, Kamala Lopez has just released the film Equal Means Equal, which will be shown Friday as part of Women's Equality Week at Union Station. Tonight, we interview her and find out why we still need the Equal Rights Amendment. The film is an unflinching look at how women are treated in the United States today, examining both real-life stories and precedent-setting legal cases. Lopez uncovers how deeply rooted discrimination is at work and under the law and shows how it leads to harassment, domestic violence, sexual assault, and the stubborn persistence of unequal pay. In the news, will the case of the Medicaid 23 help Medicaid expansion in Missouri? And graduate student teaching assistants at private universities win the right to organize. Our feature at the end of the show is Washington Window on Workers with Mark Grinberg. Now for the news.
Barb Shelley, who retired from the Kansas City Star, recently is now writing for The Pitch. True to her combative spirit, she's written an article on a Medicaid 23. Calling their trial for trespassing an amazing disgrace, Shelley said the prosecution of the 23 mostly black and elderly pastors for trespassing because they demanded access to health care was racist and intolerant and reflected badly on Missouri. She asked, does anyone think a group of white activists would be put on trial for visiting the Senate chambers and boisterously calling for an expansion of gun rights? However, Shelley finds some hope in the case. She says, by dragging the pastors into court more than 2 years after they were arrested, Senate Republican leaders and Cole County Prosecuting Attorney Mark Richardson have unwittingly reinvigorated the push for Medicaid expansion in Missouri. 19 states, including Missouri, have not passed Medicaid expansion, leaving about 11% of its citizens without any affordable health care. Advocates for expansion lost the 2014 session. There has been hope in the overwhelming Republican-dominated legislature since, but Shelley believes the case of the Medicaid 23 will reinvigorate the fight. Next January, after elections and term limits cleanse a few of the strongest opponents, and we have a new governor. As for the current legislature, Shelley says they have a strange set of values. Lawmakers won't even think about capping campaign contributions because that, they say, would limit the free speech of multimillionaires like Rex Sinkefield. But ministers singing in the Senate gallery constitutes trespassing? Go figure.
Obama's National Labor Relations Board has scored another hit for workers' rights. On Tuesday, the NLRB at long last recognized that graduate teaching and research assistants at private universities are indeed employees and thus have the right to organize unions to represent them. In a case from New York's Columbia University, the board overruled its 2004 decision, which said graduate student TAs are primarily students and have primarily educational, not economic relationships with their university. Faculty at private universities do not have the right to organize because the NLRB years ago decided they engage in shared governance and are therefore part of management. But universities increasingly rely on contingent faculty to teach. One estimate is that the proportion of tenured and tenure-track faculty in higher ed has declined from about 75% to less than one-third in the past 50 years. Neither part-time adjuncts nor graduate teaching assistants have rights to tenure nor any say over who gets hired and what the curriculum should be. Columbia University grad student union activist Paul Katz told the New York Times, "What we're fundamentally concerned about isn't really money. It's a question of power and democracy in a space in the academy that's increasingly corporatized and hierarchical. That's what we're most concerned about." Columbia University and other universities argued that collective bargaining would lead to a more adversarial relationship between students and the university that would undermine its educational purpose, and that unions would try to dictate academic matters. However, the NLRB disagreed, saying the grad students were employees as they perform and are paid for work that the university oversees, even if their relationship was substantially broader.
Workers Independent News reports that on Monday, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the workers cannot be forced to sign away their rights to class action lawsuits in favor of private arbitration. Tara Zumer was fired from the office-sharing company WeWork for refusing to sign an arbitration agreement that would have waived not only class action claims but also the right to trial by jury. She says Monday's Ninth Circuit decision supports her current wage and hour case before the National Labor Relations Board. Zumer, for probably the last 10 years or so, companies have been including these types of clauses in contracts, and I'm glad to see that my case happens to be falling at a time when the courts are starting to determine the legality of these types of clauses. Honestly, I'm hoping one day that the Supreme Court will rule that it's absolutely illegal for a company to prevent employees from collective action, which is really what arbitration agreements do. They make it cheaper and easier for a company to fight individuals one at a time instead of as a group. We really need the government and our judicial system to start supporting its citizens rather than companies.
The Obama administration has issued its final rule and 369 pages of guidance telling federal contractors on how to evaluate labor law compliance, or lack of it, by bidders for federal work. The federal government is one of the largest, if not the largest, buyer of goods and services in the U.S., so its decision to award or yank contracts can have a big impact. Many federal contractors are labor lawbreakers. In just the Defense Department alone, data shows 49 firms with wage and hour law violations got $81 billion in federal contracts last year. Most federal contractors play by the rules, but tens of thousands of American workers are denied overtime wages, are unlawfully discriminated against in hiring or pay, have their health or safety put at risk by federal contractors who cut corners, or are otherwise denied basic workplace protections. Last month, the Obama administration ordered the Department of Labor, the EEOC, and the NLRB to start reporting data on which firms are lawbreakers to federal contracting authorities. The new rules do not outright ban labor lawbreaking firms from getting federal contracts, but they do tell federal contract officers to give great weight to labor lawbreaking when evaluating whether a company should win federal business or not. Information for this story comes from PIA and People's Weekly World.
The news tonight was read by Shaikalyn Hams, Molly Madden, Lincoln Dreyer, and I'm Judy Ansel.
Sending big waves into motion, like how a single word can make a heart open. explosion. And all those things I didn't say, wrecking balls inside my brain. I will scream loud tonight. Can you hear my voice this time? This is my fight song. Take back my life song. Prove I'm all right song. My power's turned on.
Stop it right now.
I'll be strong. I'll play my fight song. And I don't really care if nobody else believes. Cause I've still got a lot of fight left in me. Losing friends and I'm chasing sleep. Everybody's worried about me. In 2D.
My name is Shaikolyn Hams, and I will be co-producing tonight's episode. Today, I will be interviewing Camela Lopez, who is an actress, filmmaker, activist, and president of the Horoka Films. Ms. Lopez is also executive producer and director of the documentary Equal Means Equal. Ms. Lopez was born in New York City to an Indian mother and a Venezuelan father. Lopez has worked as an actor in over 30 films, including Born in East L.A., Deep Cover, The Burning Sensation, which won 2 Emmys, 3 Golden Globes, and also she was an actress in Clear and Present Danger. Lopez is a Yale University graduate in philosophy and theater studies. The documentary Equal Means Equal is a labor of love that Lopez embarked on over 6 years ago when she realized that women still did not have constitutional protections in the United States and that most Americans did not know that. By the way, Equal Means Equal won Michael Moore's Best U.S. Documentary Audience Award at the Traverse City Film Festival in 2016. Equal Means Equal offers an unflinching look at how women are treated in the United States today. Lopez has launched the movement and film Equal Means Equal to educate Americans about the importance of equal rights under the federal law for women. Can you tell me what moved you to produce Equal Means Equal, and what is the meaning behind the title?
Hi. Well, first of all, I'm so excited to be on the show with you. Thank you so much for all that all of you are doing on Women's Equality Day. And I'm thrilled about this because I feel like it's a historic moment. Not only do we have our first woman candidate running for the highest office in the land, but we also have a growing awareness that even though we have a Women's Equality Day, we don't actually have women's equality. And that is a really, I mean, it's humorous in, if you have very dark humor, but for most Americans who believe that men and women have equal rights, it's kind of like a sick joke that nobody explained to us. I didn't know anything about it myself. I thought that men and women were equal. I had been raised under the narrative that I think most women today that are of my generation or younger have, which is that we can be, do, and have whatever we want, that we are empowered, that we are equal, and that we have the same opportunities that men have in our society. So the fact of the matter is that we don't. And when I discovered this very basic underlying injustice that is in our U.S. Constitution, it really shocked me. It shocked me because it seemed like such a basic human and civil right that we all take for granted that just isn't there. When our Constitution was written in 1787, women were actually property. They were chattel. The legal model for slaves was taken from the legal model for wives. So to this day, the only additional right that we have achieved as women, as a gender-specific right in our Constitution, is the right to vote. All other things remain the same. I wanted to find out what the lack of equal rights under our foundational document, the Constitution, what the impact of that was on women generally and on various issues specifically. I started out looking at about 24, 25 different issues where I thought women were experiencing gender-based or sex-based discrimination. I've narrowed that down ultimately in the final film, Equal Means Equal, to about a dozen categories that are the most egregious and that are the easiest to show why we need these equal rights under the U.S. Constitution.
And what are these categories?
Well, the gender pay gap is one that affects all working women today, which make up 47% of the U.S. labor force. The gender pay gap is still in full force, and it breaks down by race. It breaks down across all different kinds of categories. But the bottom line is that Bloomberg, which is hardly a leftist progressive news gathering organization, came out with a study last year that said that in 99.6% of all major occupation categories, women made less than men in those same categories. Now, there is no way, no how, that that is not discrimination. No matter how you try to somersault around the numbers or play with semantics, the fact of the matter is that women are experiencing a severe gender pay gap. And 70% of our poor in the United States are women and the children who depend upon them. So we see that this is a very big problem. So that's a major issue in the film that we discuss. Another issue that most young people are not aware of until, unfortunately, it becomes something extremely personal is pregnancy discrimination. The laws that we have in place to protect pregnant women definitively do not do so. What they do is protect corporations from behaving poorly and discriminating against pregnant women, and it gives them a free pass at the end of the day. Violence against women, rape statistics, domestic violence, on and on and on, the issues that impact women disproportionately than men are varied and vast and are all positively impacted by having underlying human and civil rights legislation at a federal level.
Absolutely. Would you say that substantive equality affects women's reproductive rights?
Of course. Substantive equality affects all aspects of women's lives. And one of the things that I found remarkable in doing this investigation was that the doctrine of similarly situated, meaning that the court or a judge will look at something based on how it affects a similarly situated party. Well, for one thing, men cannot be similarly situated to women in various areas, including pregnancy, including our reproductive health care needs. So that in and of itself is discriminatory because men are taken as the standard baseline human being. You know, that is the model. And then everything works off of that as normative or normal. And so our reproductive biology becomes something weird, something odd, something that needs additional legislation or additional sort of, an additional things made up for it instead of understanding, no, this is not unusual or unnormative. This is part of what it is to be a human being, is to have these particular functions that are not and cannot, by definition, be similarly situated to that of a male human being.
You mentioned rapes in regards to women's suffrage, and I noticed that in your film, which was excellent, your documentary,
you
said that 100 rapes occur. If you look at 100 rapes, 32 rapes are reported. Of that 32 that are reported, only 7% continue with investigations, and there's only a 2% rate of conviction. And so my question to you is, what is the cost of being raped in America?
Well, according to Ultraviolet, it costs the average cost of being raped is over
$151,000.
$151,000? Okay. But, But that, I'm sure, people will come out of the woodwork to argue and parse that out. The bottom line, and what I would like us to keep focusing on, is how epic the problem is that you can look at something where there is a crime, a violent crime, an assault being perpetrated on a citizen that is having a less than 2% response. Now, that in and of itself is clearly gender-based injustice and discrimination. And the more that we can point to these huge statistics, for example, the fact that we talk about the lives lost in Afghanistan during the wars for the past 10 years from 2002 to 2012, we look at it's about 1,800 lives lost. Well, in that same amount of time, in the United States, over 10,600 women lost their lives at the hands of domestic partners and abusers. And nothing is being done to staunch that bloodbath that flows every day through our streets and is accepted. It is not enforced. It is not litigated. It is just the environment of fear and intimidation that women are forced to live in because of a lack of enforcement of gender-based discrimination.
Now, when you mentioned domestic violence, is there any research to show that a woman who is abused is actually part of creating a pipeline to prison? Females who are incarcerated, 99% of them, have been abused by a man. Do you think because of our domestic violence policies that we're helping to create this pipeline to prison for women?
There's no doubt that our justice system penalizes women in a completely distinct manner than they penalize men for the same crimes. From my investigations and my statistics, it looks like violent crime for women is extremely unusual, with the exception of in one case. And that, as you said, is when a woman has been or is being battered or her children are being battered. 85% of women serving life sentences for homicide, over 85%, I believe, were there because they killed somebody that had been beating them. In the United States, if you use self-defense and you're a battered woman, you will not win. You will serve long prison sentences. Whereas a gentleman, and I use that word with, you know, great looseness,
yes,
like George Zimmerman, who was arrested for shooting an unarmed teenager dead, was not arrested. He was not charged. He was not brought in any way to the criminal justice system until there was a public uproar, whereas a woman like Marissa Alexander in the state of Florida,
yes,
was served a sentence of 20 years for shooting a warning shot into her garage against her husband, who had a restraining order against him for abuse. So we see very clearly that our judges, And I have a feeling this has to do with the general demographic of our judges. They tend to be older, they tend to be white, and they tend to be male, and they just don't think that women should get out of line, you know? I mean, a lot of them have very, very backward views on domestic violence. There was a time until, and in some cases, I believe in some states, you can still rape your wife with absolutely no legal consequence. So, you know, for us to pretend that we are not living in a sexist society, or to have amnesia about the fact that it was very, very recent when we couldn't have a credit card or buy our own homes or anything, I think it's quite dangerous. It's quite dangerous not to finish the job. And the only way you finish the job is by enshrining in federal legislation women's equality. Because right now, doing it on a state-by-state basis is extremely dangerous. And it's depending on the kindness of whatever batch of legislators made their way into the halls of power on this round, and it's just not appropriate to leave our civil and human rights up to such, whimsy.
While you were doing your research for this film, did you find if there was more pay equity in women, for women who belong to labor unions?
Well, I have always belonged to a labor union, and I believe strongly, yes, labor unions and women, I mean, just between you and I and whoever's listening, mm-hmm. I truly believe that women and labor need to join forces to create a third party that speaks to the real America. You know, we're 65% of minimum wage workers, women are. And labor unions are the true pathway to the middle class for America. It's, you know, I believe in the unions very strongly. The only thing that I've heard, however, is that there is still unconscious or conscious gender bias within the unions that does affect promotions and, you know, selection and stuff like that. But hey, at least we're talking about some rules, some transparency, some guidelines towards moving up a pension, proper living, a living environment for workers. I absolutely believe in the unions.
I have a question. I'm curious about this. Why do you feel that prejudice against blacks or people of color is unacceptable, whereas prejudice against women is acceptable?
Well, there are a lot of sort of psychological reasons that I could that I can imagine. I mean, I'm not a sociologist or a psychologist, but I do see that women themselves have internalized a great deal of the very prejudices that hold us back. And I am not of the ilk that say lean in, try harder, because I know that, you know, when you're making $6 an hour and your boss is harassing you and you need that money because you've got two kids at home, leaning in is a completely absurd suggestion. But I do feel that women themselves need to start being braver, I guess is what I would say. I take a page out of some of the more active revolutions that are occurring not only in our country but all over the world, and say, you know, we demand equal rights as human beings and stand up for ourselves a little bit more. I think women are more likely also to try to help other people. We don't feel as comfortable focusing on ourselves and helping ourselves. We would rather go and help, you know, the homeless veteran down the road, or go
yes.
volunteer at the animal shelter. But mm-hmm. my point, and I feel this so very strongly, is that until women help themselves, until we help ourselves, we cannot do what we need and must do immediately, which is help the planet and save mankind as a species, because we're in a very delicate position from a very macro point of view, and I see women as the solution. So for me, ERA is the first step on a road to save the world. And, you know, we do that through woman power. We do that through raising the levels of participation of women and eliminating this gender imbalance that is causing everything to tilt towards certain types of behaviors that I argue are more male than female, you know, violence and sort of rampant acquisitiveness and greed and moving continually quickly forward without really assessing where we are and where we're going and the environment and our children and et cetera. So I believe that women hold the key, and so therefore we must think about ourselves. It is our duty. It is not a selfish act. It is, in fact, the most selfless act we can take, and it's a critical one.
Absolutely. I have another question for you. CEDAW. For our listeners, CEDAW is a convention on the elimination of all forms of discrimination against women, and it's an international treaty adopted in 1979 by the United Nations General Assembly. What role did CEDAW play in the making of your film?
Well, CEDAW was something that I discovered, as I discovered many of the things that you will see in the film, because I really had no idea that there was such a treaty. You know, it's called the Women's Bill of Rights, sort
yes.
of casually. It
uh-huh.
it doesn't make a distinction about women. It says that women deserve all the rights of human beings and participating as human beings in society. And it's been signed by most of the countries in the world. There are only 7 countries that have not signed it. And what is incredibly astonishing, and something that I did not know, and I'm sure many of our listeners do not know, is that along with Tonga, Sudan, Papua New Guinea, and I don't know whatever else, we're not weird countries, but certainly, you know, not the United States of America, let's put it that way. We are the only country not to have signed that document, because it causes a sort of lackadaisical attitude internationally about enforcing it, because why people look at the United States as supposedly a leader in progressive issues and leader in women's rights, and here we are refusing to sign a treaty that would protect women that are not dealing with a gender pay gap. They're dealing with being shot in the head. They're dealing with being buried up to their necks and having stones thrown at them until they're dead. And we are sort of casually taking this in a very cavalier manner, and it's inappropriate. But as far as what CEDAW had to do with the film, well, it is connected to ERA. It is connected to us, because what I found out was one of the main reasons we will not sign CEDAW is because it would grandfather in ERA. It supersedes ERA in terms of being international law.
It does.
So that would compel the U.S. government to pay women equally to men. It would compel all of our labor laws to be reassessed from a perspective of gender pay discrimination. And apparently our government is not interested in that. Well, I say, get interested.
I am woman, hear me roar, in numbers too big to ignore.
This is Shai Kalin. We're talking to Camila Lopez about her new documentary, Equal Means Equal. And my question to you is, can we legislate our way out of female discrimination soon?
Well, this is, you cannot legislate yourself out of people's mindsets in a very quick fashion. But what you can absolutely do, and we've done this before and will continue to do it, is to stand together as a society and say, no, we do not accept that. Okay? We don't allow murder in our society. It's not something we condone. If you do that, we all think you're very bad, and there are consequences to that. So when we pass ERA, when we ratify ERA, what we're doing is saying publicly as a society and legally as a society, no, we do not accept sex discrimination. It is not tolerated by us. And if you do it, you will be punished. Walmart, UPS, Albertsons, whoever you are, we don't really care how big you are or how much money you have. This is not something that you can do. Now, once that's in place, it's going to be much more difficult for, first of all, the government will have to stop any areas where they happen to be discriminating. That's going to be a big deal in the military. But corporations, private companies, are going to be looking at this situation and thinking, gee whiz, we better look and see if we're doing this, because we don't want any trouble. And that's how things slowly begin to change. And if you look at the mentality of young people today, of 20-year-olds, that discriminatory attitude about women I don't see it. I mean, we are living in a time when most young people accept homosexuality and gay marriage as absolutely okay and part of the rights of all human beings. So when they just find out that women were sort of leapfrogged over somehow by history, they won't stand for it. And I don't think we're going to have a big cultural or mental problem with those generations. It's just the older generations that are still stuck in the past.
Do you think the Supreme Court is a corporate court?
There's no question that this is the most corporate court that we have ever had. We've seen over and over again that they choose a corporation over an individual, that they choose to make it more difficult for individuals to have their day in court. We saw that in the Walmart case. We saw that with Lilly Ledbetter. We see it, I mean, this is precisely why women must, in this upcoming election, utilize the one right that they have been given by our government, which is the right to vote, to ensure that whoever is in office is not selecting a Supreme Court justice or two who are stuck in, you know, forget 1950, I mean, let's say 1450, I mean, honestly. So we've got to really take our vote very seriously, I feel.
Okay.
And that's one of the reasons I made Equal Means Equal, was to motivate the public after they see the film to get out there and make a difference on this issue, to call their congresspeople, their elected officials locally, and say, look, where are we standing on the Equal Rights Amendment? This is just ridiculous that we're still tolerating this, and we're not going to.
You mentioned in your documentary that sexism is not a glass ceiling, but a brick wall. What's the difference?
Well, actually, that comment was Jennifer Reich, who is the attorney for one of the team of attorneys at Equal Rights Advocates who were representing the Walmart plaintiffs, including Betty Dukes. We had a situation at Walmart where, despite whatever they were saying, it was literally one-third of management was female, two-thirds was male, mm-hmm. and two-thirds of the floor workers and the minimum wage workers were female, and one-third were male. They would say things like, oh, well, Dan has to support a family. That's why he got the promotion and the raise. Not being enough in the present moment to understand that 75% of school children in America today have working mothers.
Yes. Yes.
So this attitude that men have families to raise and women don't is just out of touch. And, you know, we know that Walmart, well, there was so much evidence against Walmart that was, in fact, the reason that the case didn't go forward. It was just too much, too much. That kind of a court that makes that choice to choose one company over 1.6 million women is not a court that we can afford to have at the you know, making these incredibly important decisions for our country.
Okay, so what do you think is next for women? What's next for women?
I think we are in the midst of a revolution. I think when people look back in 10, 20, 50, or 100 years, they'll say, these were revolutionary times. We see it across multiple spectrums of our society. We see it in the Occupy movements. We see it in the Black Lives Matter movements. We see it in the women's movement. We need to take ownership of this revolution. We need to stand up and be proud of who we are and demand the rights that we know we deserve. And we need to stop making excuses and apologies for a system that is serving an America that is long gone, rather than a system that is serving the America that is here today and that desperately needs support. Well, I'm very excited to say that we just returned from our world premiere film festival in Traverse City, Michigan. It's a festival put on by the great Michael Moore, one of the best documentarians the world has ever seen, and certainly America's top documentarian. And I'm so proud and excited that Equal Means Equal won Best Documentary, Best U.S. Documentary, the Audience Award from the Traverse City Film Festival. So, and that was our first showing to in a festival. So I'm very excited about that.
Kamala, thank you so much for the interview.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure. And thanks to everyone for all your hard work that you're doing out there every day to make it a better world for women and girls. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you.
She's just a girl and she's on fire, hotter than a fantasy, lonely like a highway.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel, and with me is Shaikalyn. Great interview, Shaikalyn.
Oh, thank you.
We're going to continue the conversation a little bit by focusing in on some of the issues that are mentioned in the movie. And let me say that the movie is going to be shown tomorrow, Friday evening, at, I believe it's 6 o'clock at Union Station, and all are invited to come see it. It's really worth seeing. And gosh, it's made me a proponent of the Equal Rights Amendment again.
Again.
Yeah, I remember the past fight and I sort of gave up, but it seems like the time's come around again. So talking about some of the issues, issues that are focused in the film are the gender pay gap, of course, always, pregnancy discrimination and maternity rights, domestic violence, rape and sexual assault, female poverty, child sex trafficking, healthcare and reproductive rights, juvenile justice, prison, and rates of female incarceration. All really serious issues for women. So what about the gender pay gap? Of the 100 million Americans living in poverty, 70% are women and children. So the gender pay gap obviously makes a huge difference. Women make up nearly half of the U.S. workforce. Full participants, they've reached equal, in some cases higher, levels than their male counterparts. And yet, as the Women's Institute of Policy Research makes plain, the gap between men and women income remains. Compared to white men, white women working full-time based on median annual full-time earnings earn 78 cents to every dollar a man earns. African American women make 64 cents and Latinas make 54 cents. Depending on the year, that pay may rise a couple of pennies, but not because women's wages have increased, rather because men's wages have stagnated or declined. What about pregnancy discrimination and maternity rights? The U.S. is the only developed nation that does not provide mandatory maternity leave and has a rising mortality rate. That's right, a rising mortality rate. Isn't that amazing in the United States today?
That is.
Congress passed the Pregnancy Discrimination Act in 1978, yet pregnant women, especially those in low-wage and physically demanding jobs, are routinely fired or forced off the job when they get pregnant. Although a dozen states and cities have passed additional legislation to protect pregnant women, there needs to be a national standard. There are more shelters for animals in the United States than safe havens for battered women. Shaikalyn?
Okay, let's get into a harder subject here, something that's not so pleasant. Every 9 seconds, a woman is assaulted or beaten. Domestic violence. Every 24 hours, 3 women die at the hands of a current or former partner. Every year, 4,000 women perish from domestic violence. These facts are repeated so often that they lose their meaning, their impact. Now, if you compare domestic violence to war, the number of American soldiers killed on a battlefield in 2012 was 2,002. The number of American women murdered by their current or former partner during the same time frame was a staggering 11,766. A large number of the abusers, those who abuse, they go back to their abusers, and you wonder why. The number one reason for their return is their abusers hold total financial control and money was the weapon of their choice. Move on down the line and discuss female poverty. You know, what happens to the women who fail our systems? Are women paid too little over their lifetimes to escape plunging into poverty? Many of these women end up hiding in the shadows of cities and small towns throughout America in abandoned buildings, cars, or cardboard boxes. They live in fear and anguish. The United States has the largest number of homeless women and children among industrialized nations in the world. This is unacceptable. Regarding labor and women, there are approximately 2,500 million women in the labor force. 53% of these women were concentrated in three industries: education, health services, trade, and local government. Women are overrepresented in several industries and underrepresented in others. For example, in 2010, women represented 79% of health and social services workforce and 68% of education services. However, women only represented 43.2% of professional, scientific, and technical jobs, as we call it, STEM. That is unacceptable. And this is, these statistics are according to Department of Labor 2011. Now, all of these struggles that women go through has a lot to do with Equal Rights Amendment. And I'll refresh your memory about equal rights. The Equal Rights Amendment was a proposed amendment to the United States Constitution designed to guarantee equal rights for women. In 1923, it was introduced into Congress for the first time. The Equal Rights Amendment was passed in Congress on March 22, 1972, and it was sent to states for ratification by both houses of their state legislatures. A proposed amendment becomes part of the Constitution only when approved by three-fourths of the 50 states, which is 38. To date, since 1972, the ERA does not have the necessary ratification votes to become law. Again, that's unacceptable. 73% of the American population believe that women already have equal rights under the Constitution. 96% of Americans believe that women should be guaranteed equality in the Constitution. More astounding, 72% of Americans believe that women already have rights. But guess what? This still does not exist in the Constitution. So what is needed? The Equal Rights Amendment is needed to affirm constitutionally the bedrock principles of democracy that all men are created equal. The ERA, until it's ratified by all states, does not guarantee the rights and protections for all citizens without regard to sex. Without the ERA, women regularly and men occasionally have to fight long, expensive, and difficult legal battles to prove that their rights to equality should exist. So in conclusion, here are some parting thoughts for our listeners. Is there a war for women? Is there a war on women? The poverty of women and children brings down nations. Multiple studies have shown that what is good for women is good for the community. Economic analysis by the World Bank, United Nations, Goldman Sachs demonstrate that a significant number the economic correlation between equality and the development of countries has a lot to do with what goes on with women. So I ask you this question to your listeners. Can we legislate our way out of female discrimination soon? And will the ERA be enough?
Hi, this is Judy Ansel, and with me on the phone is Mark Grunberg, and it's time for this month's Washington Window on Workers. Are you there, Mark?
Yes.
Ah, okay. Good. We have valiant substitute engineer tonight, Lincoln Dreyer, and he's doing a great job. But, you know, there's a lot of buttons to push. So, Mark, we want to talk about what's going on in Missouri, and you call in one of your articles in last month. You said that Missouri was a three-ring circus politically this year. Now, that's really interesting because Missouri usually, you know, in the last few elections is, you know, always put in the R column and everybody writes it off. So Why did you call it a three-ring circus?
Well, I call it a three-ring circus not so much because of the presidential race, where Mr. Trump has a slight lead. I think it's about 6 or 7 points in the polls. But because of everything else, virtually every single statewide office, with the possible exception of attorney general, is up. Senator, governor, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, the Kit Kat and Caboodle. And the legislature, and given the makeup of the legislature, all those other races are important because the legislature is so heavily gerrymandered in favor of anti-worker forces.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why Missouri is a three-ring circus, and I'm not the only one saying that.
So. Right. So there's a lot at stake, and you know we never got to reprise the August primary. But I wanted to ask you a few things about who the winners were. I mean, one of the things was that labor unions were actually in certain races asking their members to vote in the Republican side of the primary in order to defend some of the folks who had voted against right to work in the legislature. How did that turn out?
It came out, at least from what I could tell, it came out sort of a tie in four or five. There were something like six key races where the anti-right-to-work Republican was running, and the GOP was trying, particularly this right-wing millionaire down in Joplin, was trying to knock them off. Excuse me, and it basically came out 3-3. Three wins, three losses.
So,
that means for the overall makeup of the legislature, I can't tell you. I'm a little too far away.
Okay, so what happened to one of the ones that was targeted was actually a Democrat, Courtney Curtis from Ferguson, who supported a right to work bill. I think he introduced one of his own. And he was targeted by unions. He won.
The opposition was split.
Ah, well. Okay, we'll see in November.
If the third candidate had dropped out, he would have lost. So,
okay, and then there's this campaign called Preserve Middle Class Inc., which is being run by the unions, targeting David Humphreys, who is that roofing business owner from Joplin, who's been pumping millions of dollars into anti-union ads.
Right,
Can you tell us something about that campaign?
Well, that campaign is going to be a lot of shoe leather. It's going to be people going door to door in both St. Louis and Kansas City and the surrounding areas, explaining why and trying to explain why you should vote for pro-worker candidates rather than for the people whom Humphreys is pushing on his on-the-air ads. He's spending millions of dollars on-the-air ads. It's going to be a lot of work, and it's going to have to get outside of just St. Louis and Kansas City too,
right?
Despite the gerrymandering in the legislature.
Yeah. Well, Dave Cook, who's the chairman of that campaign, Preserve the Middle Class Inc., said, I think it was he who said, or else the campaign said, according to your article, GOP mega donor Humphreys is spending millions to attack the hardworking middle class union members who support Chris Koster, who's, of course, the candidate for governor, the current Democratic Attorney General who's running for governor, and the pro-labor Republicans who helped sustain retiring Democrat Governor Jay Nixon. Simply put, if the 2016 campaign cycle becomes debate about union dues, we lose. And so is that the thrust of it, that they're trying to make it a debate about whether or not you should have to pay union dues?
Well, that's what this millionaire down in Joplin has tried to make it a debate about. We, meaning workers, have to make it a debate about: Are you going to preserve your jobs, your lifestyle, your income, your standard of living? Put it that way, and it becomes very, very different.
Right.
Because that's what right to work threatens. Right to work threatens all of those.
Okay. Well, I'm sure we'll be revisiting this, Mark. We're out of time right now. Thank you so much. We've been talking to Mark Gruenberg of Press Associates, Inc. in Washington, D.C., with this week's Washington Window on Workers, which is actually Missouri. Thanks, Mark.
Yes.
Bye-bye.
Okay, you're welcome. Talk to you later.
Bye. And now for the calendar.
This is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar, August 25th, 2016. Women's Equality Work, Equal Means Equal, the film. Friday, August 26th, 5:30 reception, 6 p.m. film, 6:30 talkback. Union Station, 30 West Pershing Road, KCMO. For the week's schedule, go to Women's Equality, capital GKC, on Facebook. Labor Day Picnic, Saturday, August 27th, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m., Longview Lake Beach in Raytown Road, Lee Summit. Fannie Lou Hamer, Women's Committee, presents The Story of Ella Baker, Saturday, August 27th, 11 a.m., Tivoli Theater. Labor Day Concert by Cindy Novello, Friday, September 2nd at 7 p.m., Cider Gallery, 810 Pennsylvania in Lawrence. Cindy will honor workers at the concert who put their heart and soul into their work, including our own Heartland Labor Forum, Ariana Eckel.
Okay, and that's it for tonight's show. You can find our calendar on our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can find our archived shows and our upcoming schedule. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. We're going to be finding out about a new organization called Surge, Standing Up for Racial Justice. And we'll be covering Hillary on labor issues. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Lincoln Dreyer, and stay tuned for the Thursday night special.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.